Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 146 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Will Slater of Exploding Helicopter. Welcome to the show, Will.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me on to talk about The Great Escape.
Yeah, sorry there are no helicopters in it, but maybe we'll try and find something during the course of the week that might satisfy you a little bit. We'll see.
I'll keep my fingers crossed.
You know, I don't think they have helicopters back in World War II?
They did have some helicopters in World War II, but they weren't terribly common. They weren't used. If you like movies in a similar vein to The Great Escape, you can see in Where Eagles Dare, there's some World War II helicopter usage in that film. If you want to see sort of helicopters of that vintage in action.
Minute 146 starts off with Blythe and Henley ducking under the wing, and goes all the way till the duo attach together the prop crank. Basically, as we discussed last week, we're dealing with all the various prisoners, how they're trying to make their way to freedom. We found Blythe and Henley showing up at a seemingly deserted airfield, or sparsely populated airfield. They sneak in.
It hardly looks like a war zone.
No, completely not.
There's no one there. It all looks shut up and closed down.
Exactly. No one seems to have been alerted that there's a 76 prisoners of war that have somehow escaped relatively close nearby. How close in
World War II, this is the base that I would like to be dispatched to and be working at, because not a lot seems to be the war seems touched by the war.
Yeah, we'll talk about it a little bit in this minute. I don't know if this is the best place to have wanted to be either, but it's still relatively calm. You don't want to be this lone guard that we're going to meet in just a few seconds. Still, so they show up at this airfield, which we see are a whole bunch of planes. On Friday, Henley said that he thinks there's a training plane that he actually can fly, which, we discussed this on Friday, but still, it's a little strange. He's supposed to be a fighter pilot. He can't just get into any plane that's around here and figure out how to work them. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, based on your experience with exploding helicopters, are you familiar more with the technical aspects of flying a helicopter, or is it just a dream?
It's just a dream. I'm a very nervous flyer, especially after watching hundreds of movies where helicopters explode. I mean, I guess I understand the point that you're making, but I wonder if it was a simpler age of aviation where, you start the engine and you've got your, I don't know what you call it, your joystick or the pilot controls, and there's not really that much, there's not like there's a whole complicated dashboard of instruments or else.
Which would make it easier.
Well,
I would think that would make it easier. You don't have the if you have a complicated dashboard, then okay, I can understand. I can't get into the F-16 because I know how to fly the F-17. Okay, fine. The buttons are different. It's the same thing with a computer or a car or whatever. Things that are newer models are more complicated, let's say. But if your point is that things were more simplistic, then I would say the exact opposite. Then it should be easy for him to get any plane. You have the joystick, you have the prop crank, and that's it. I don't know. Again, I don't know anything about flying. I'm completely talking.
You're flying blind here.
I'm completely flying blind here. No question about that. And my name is not even Blythe. Who's out in a joyride flying blind?
Certainly is.
No, okay. So I don't know anything about planes. It was just something that came to mind as to, you have a fighter pilot that can only fly a very small plane. Okay. Maybe they said he's an American. We're not going to train him to fly all the planes. We'll give him, he was an American in the RAF. We'll let him just fly this little training plane. Maybe he was out for a joyride and got shot down on this, first flight and didn't really have much experience.
Yeah, who knows?
Anything's possible. Exactly. That's what's great. You can always speculate. we can create histories for every one of these characters that are completely bonkers, that make no sense whatsoever, but because we just know them during the course of this 172 minutes where we get to see them. So you never know what happens to them before or after. Anyone who wants to write fan fiction, go right ahead. Send it to us. I'd love to hear it. Love to read it. You can even do a video. Do a fan fiction YouTube video about what you think the history of Henley is, or the history of Blythe. you know, what happened to them before they got here.
Yeah. I mean, how did he get to be? Yep. I mean, he's the scrounger, isn't he, of this movie? Hendley is. And, you know, so how did he become to get to that position? You know, does he have some sort of criminal backstory that, you know, means that he, you know, was able to draw on those skills to, yeah, sort of inveigle, you know, supplies out of the Germans, as you say, yeah,
exactly.
Stuff to be explored in fact.
Because unfortunately, James Gardner's not around anymore. That we can, you know, make a prequel with him. I'm sure they could find, you know, some actor who looks similar to him to do a prequel.
Well, with all this sort of de-aging technology, we hardly need the real James Gardner now to put him into a prequel.
Okay. I see your point there. Not everyone is Carrie Fisher, where there, you know, you can do that. Peter Cushing, Carrie Fisher. I guess you need the name brand, you know, have enough footage of them from around that time. Who knows? Okay, so back to Hendley and Blythe, who are sneaking under the wing, which is just hilarious the way they do it. You know, they duck down, and the whole time, you know, Hendley, because Blythe is blind, he's basically pushing him. You know, like, he has his hand around his neck and pushing him down and picking him up and moving him to the side. You know, he's like a ventriloquist dummy, the way that he's, you know, moving him along here. Just hilarious. So they go under the wing, and then they stealthily run to the side of the hangar, and he pushes him up against the wall, which, again, they're doing this silently. Nobody can hear them whatsoever.
It's a very quiet minute that we have here. I mean, there's no dialogue. Completely. Well, there's one line. Well, half
there's
a line,
one
really.
Line of dialogue. We have a full line. Full line of dialogue. Completely full line of dialogue. It's a full sentence. Let's put it that way. It cuts off into the next sentence, but we'll get to that later in the minute. The thing I love, first of all, is if you see when the two of them stand up against the wall of the hangar, did you see Blythe's face?
I don't recall his expression at that moment.
He has this expression on his face like, why the hell am I here? What am I doing here? You know, he's supposed to be blind. You know, Hendley backs up against the wall, does like this quick, he swiftly does a spin around so that he's looking out. And when he does so, you can see that, I mean, this, Hendley is a character throughout the entire movie. He's walking around with his sparkling white turtleneck. And here you have him, you know, where his collar is up on his shirt, and he's got a few buttons opened up. You also have Colin with a few buttons opened up. They look pretty disheveled by the way that they look here. This journey has taken its toll.
Well, I think you'd expect that.
You know, jumping off the train.
I think you'd expect that. Yeah.
Right, but if part of the whole idea is to keep up the guise and the impression that things, you know, that they're supposed to blend in. So they need to do their best to not look
so disheveled.
Yeah,
they probably should try and find a laundrette at some point soon.
Exactly. I wonder if you noticed this. At the beginning, when they both escape, they're both carrying bags. They have small little satchels or whatever. And then when they jump off the train, they have one.
And now? Okay.
And now they have none.
I had that note because they've lost their man bags, which I thought that was a very metrosexual touch for a World War II or a 1960s movies that all of the escapees have, you know, sort of, you know, very nice, very attractive looking little leather man bags.
Yes. I discussed this a few weeks ago and come to an answer about it. You know, where did they get so much leather to make these bags? We know where they got all the cloth to make the uniforms and to make their suits and stuff like that. And my question also is, where do they get the materials to make all the hats? Every one of them leaves with a hat. Of course, the two of them also don't have hats here anymore. They've lost their hats along the way, too.
The power of movie magic can explain the availability of leather and the disappearing hats.
Yes. Well, disappearing is easy. You know, you lost it in Illinois. That's it. It would be more interesting if in the next scene you see them with hats. But the fact that they keep the continuity and you can't see the fact they've lost the hats. That's it. No problem. So you also get to see Hendley is panting. He's had a little bit of trouble with this. You know, he's not in as good shape as we thought he might have been beforehand.
He needs to do a bit more aerobic.
Maybe
fitness,
it's just because
doesn't he,
I think. Exactly. Maybe because he's been, you know, pulling Blythe with him the whole time. Maybe that is
just stop shoving him around so much, and he wouldn't find himself being quite so knackered out.
Exactly. Within a few seconds, we'll see that that's actually not even true. It looks that he's completely knackered, as you say, but he's not, because he just takes a couple deep breaths and then he sprints out. And I love the way that he just tackles the guard. You know, he basically puts himself prone on the ground and trips him.
It is, yeah.
You know, that's the way to do it. He tackles him quite effectively. Maybe you know, we'll go back to Henley's backstory. You know, before he was, you know, arrested for larceny at some point, you know, he was a high school football star. He's able to tackle the quarterback.
I have to say, I was quite unimpressed by how James Garner tackles this particular soldier. Because, as you say, he just sort of lies prone on the ground and then just sort of rolls into his legs. And this soldier is beaten really quite easily. You know, I mean, Garner does sort of then get up and, you know, give him one of these magical movie punches to the face, which just instantly, you know, KOs the soldier.
But, no, he kicks him. He kicks him.
He
in the
kicks
face.
Him. Sorry, yes, I think yeah.
But there's one of those magical kicks. Yeah, exactly.
One of those magical kicks. Yeah, and he's immediately knocked out. But
right, but you did mention earlier the fact apparently he's in a high priority base, so they're not going to put their best guards there.
Well, he's no example of the master race, that's for sure. This particular soldier. That's
That's why he's standing on guard in probably the middle of Poland somewhere. You know, being the lone guard watching over 7 or 8 planes.
But it's, it's kind of good to see some James Garner Fu here with his kind of, hand-to-hand martial arts combat. I mean, it's a peculiar style. It's an individual style, but it does prove effective. So, you know, perhaps I should give him more credit than I perhaps am at the moment.
Right. No, I agree with you. It just looks very funny the way that he does it. It's just not, the choreography isn't that great. Let's put it that way. But as we both said, it's effective. And I think that's what he needs to do. But it's just funny because he kicks him in the head and then he sort of does a fake sleeper hold. So maybe he was a wrestler. Maybe that's what he did as a, you know, he was a wrestler in high school.
Doesn't look to have the build to me for a wrestler, but, you know, not a sport I'm terribly familiar with. So
me neither. I'm just looking at the moves that he's making because they all look fake, like a WWF.
It's not, you know, maybe they had it's just predetermined.
it's choreographically predetermined. How's that?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. And then he just picks up his lifeless body and drags him into the hangar, you know. And he just does it really, it's pretty funny the way that he drags him also. Now, did you notice that his whole back is wet now because apparently the hangar was all wet on the airfield? I mean, you can see that.
Yes, I saw that this seems to have been a light shower recently because all the tarmac is wet. But it's quite attractive in the early morning light that we get to see in this particular scene.
Right, maybe they want us to think that he was sweating. You know, if you didn't notice, you'd think that he was sweating. So he drags him into the hangar and then basically just dumps him. He like half hides him behind some boxes. He doesn't even take the time to try to hide him more effectively. Because apparently they're not really worried that anyone else is going to be around because there is nobody else around.
Well, I guess also probably time is of the essence at this particular moment. So, yes, you know, they're this close to getting, you know, executing their escape plan to steal one of these planes. So, you know,
exactly.
Adrenaline's getting the better of them at this moment.
Right. But also what's more important is that Garner wants to make sure that nobody steals the one plane he knows how to fly. You know, what if someone else takes it before him? Then he's in trouble. You gotta blow it up. Sorry. Someone took the one little plane I knew how to fly.
That would be...
We'll have to go to another airfield.
Well, do they just have to hope it was equally as quiet as this one?
Yes. And then they walk onto the tarmac. Again, Garner is pushing Blythe in front of him. He's like, if anyone shoots, they're gonna get you first.
Well,
you know? He's his bodyguard. I know.
Yeah, well, I think Garner.
We'll talk about that next week.
We're going to be getting to this, I think, in the next minute. But Garner's he's displays some real cold towards Donald Pleasance. But I think we'll get to that in the next minute.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I like the added touch that he actually does pick up the gun. When I was watching for this minute, I kept thinking to myself, I don't recall him having a gun. did he pick it up or not? And then, you know, I was happy to see that they didn't just have him leave the gun. You know, they didn't want him to say, all right, I'm a pacifist. I'm not going to pick up a gun.
He's really in the wrong job if he's a pacifist.
Yes, yes. But, I mean, if he picked up the gun, you'd think that he would have been smart and maybe checked the guard that he knocked out for a little extra ammo.
True. Very true.
But then again, he's getting in a plane and flying to Switzerland. So what does he need a gun or ammo for?
A good question. And, you know, this airfield is presumably, I mean, obviously he doesn't know how to fly them, but although I think he should know how to fly them. But, you know, they're planes with weapons, you know, with guns. I'd be far better off, you know, taking one of those in case he gets involved in an aerial dogfight of some description. But no, he just grabs the ultimately useless rifle instead.
Yes, because he's gonna open up the cockpit hatch and start shooting at somebody. You know, shooting at the plane coming at him.
Although George Kennedy does do that in Airport 79, the Concorde. So, you know, there is historical or movie precedent for people doing that sort of thing.
Well, and not historical before this, but after it, yes. I mean, it's possible that someone did precedent before also. That there's a reason that not many people have seen Airport 79. I saw it. I saw it years ago, and then I've seen it more than once even. Not my favorite of the airport movies, though. That definitely not. I still would choose the first one if I have to choose one of them. One of the four.
I'm not even saying
of the six.
I'd probably go Airport 5. But they all have their charms. Although I appreciate the point you're making. I mean, Airport 79 is in many ways the weakest of it. Although it does have a slightly sort of over the top, sort of insane charm. Just it sort of leaned into its ridiculousness in a very spectacular fashion.
Yes. Yeah, there's no question about that. So then basically they take a stroll along the tarmac because they're no longer running. You know, he's just walking a little bit. And the way that he's pushing Blythe is also pretty funny because he has his arm under his armpit. And it's like, if he was in front of him, he would be pulling him. But since he's behind him, he's pushing him that way. Comes across pretty comically. Then they reach the plane and he basically just pushes him up against the plane. You know, basically saying, just stand here next to the plane right before I turn on the propeller. I decided I've had enough of you. Oops, what can I say? And then he climbs up on the wing, opens up the hatch, and first thing he does is put the gun inside. And at the same time, you get to see Colin feeling around and looking for the propeller, basically checking to make sure that Garner's not trying to
bump him off.
You know, commit murder at this point. And he, like, he touches the propeller in a very strange way. It looks like he's actually caressing it, you know, which is a little strange. And then you have Henley pull out the prop crank. And then he says, the one line that we get in this, Colin, when I say go, crank this clockwise. That's all he says to him. He basically, the two of them then, they put their hands together and they're able to put the crank in to the crank hole, I guess you can call it. I don't know. What would you call
crank
it?
Crank hole works for me. At least know what you're talking about.
Exactly. That's where the minute ends. Did you have any other notes for this?
No,
minute?
I mean, we do get a little bit of the wonderful score at in the kind of first few seconds of this minute. But then after that, it becomes a silent minute, both in terms of dialogue and music. But the score of this film is fabulous. Obviously, it has a very iconic theme. But then, you know, the incidental music within it is also very good. And I enjoyed those few sort of moody seconds of music that we got just right at the beginning of this particular minute.
Yeah, the rest of the week we're going to have also some different musical cues which work really well. Elmer Bernstein did an amazing job here, no question about that, with the way he does the music, because the music gives the each segment of the movie a completely different tone, and it does it really well. Like, for instance, when they're walking among the plane, as you mentioned, it's more of a suspenseful
yes
feel, and then afterwards, sometimes it'll have a happier tone or a more somber tone. You know, it just kept changing back and forth. So I really liked the way they did that. So, do you have anything else for this minute?
No, I'm all good.
All right. So why don't you tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yes, if you are interested in finding out more about the strange way that helicopters explode in movies, check me out at explodinghelicopter.com, which is my website where I've got reviews of films where helicopters explode. We're also a podcast, so you can find us on any good podcasting app. Just look for Exploding Helicopter. And I am Twitter at Chopper Fireball if you want to keep up with the latest developments.
All right, very cool. You can contact us by email at thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. And our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. So, Will, you want to come back in tomorrow to continue talking about this escape?
You can twist my arm, much like Henley does to Blythe.
There you go. I'm going to try not to hurt you, because I don't want you to get a face full of propeller yet. You know, we'll wait until the end of the week. I need you all week.
You just shove me into those spinning rotor blades. But I wouldn't blame you.
No, I'll just send you off in the other direction.
We get to that part of the
week. All right. Well, until tomorrow, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.
Everyone, because we're winding down and we have less than 30 episodes left, I decided I'm going to do something very special for the final episode of this podcast. If anyone can please send us any questions, we're going to do a Q&A section, me and one or two other guests. So if you have any questions about The Great Escape or about doing a Movies by Minute podcast or about me or anything that you want to ask, it doesn't make a difference. You can ask us questions. And once we record episode 172, we will answer all of your questions, get them to us as quickly as possible. You know where to send them, as a private message to Facebook, to Twitter, or you can send them to email any which way that we can see the questions and no one else will see them, and we will answer them live for you. Thanks a lot, everyone.